From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. The right generally gets the rap for being anti-science. The language of political partisanship holds the right up as creationists and climate change deniers who oppose stem cell research. This same dyad holds up the left as pro-science. These are the progressives who project a love of science, defend data-driven inquiry, and even hold difficult truths in a rational embrace. That's bunk, says Alex Barrazo and Hank Campbell. Together, they challenge the left's label as the pro-science party in a new book called Science Left Behind, Feel-Good Fallacies and the Rise of the Anti-Scientific Left. One of the authors, Alex Barrazo, joins us now from KUOW in Seattle. He has a PhD in microbiology and is editor of Real Clear Science. Alex, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on.
Early in the program, you point out the instant credibility problem of any book that deals with politics. We assume a book about fallacies held by the left must be agenda-driven. Now, how do you describe yourself politically?
Well, I see myself first and foremost as someone who thinks that science should take primacy over politics. And so I don't have any particular problem with calling out either conservatives or progressives or liberals or libertarians whenever they get a scientific issue wrong. And so that's kind of how I see myself. I see myself more as a combatant for Team Science rather than for Team Blue or Team Red.
Real target here is progressives, however. How do you distinguish liberals and progressives?
Well, we talk about this early on in the book, and we basically make a separation based on social authoritarianism. So whereas liberals seem to be more interested in economic outcomes, for example, if you think a typical liberal might be a unionized police officer from New York City, for instance, whereas we see progressives as having more of a social agenda as well. So whereas conservatives are more interested in issues like sexuality and drugs, progressives are more interested in telling you how much salt you can put in your food and whether or not you can have a plastic bag in your house.
At the center of this idea is that progressives have their own sacred cows that they do not want challenged, and that their unscientific claims or support for anti-scientific policies are less likely to be scrutinized. Give us some examples of this.
Well, for instance, this just happened recently. The California Democratic Party endorsed Proposition 37, which is a movement to label genetically modified foods. Now, genetically modified foods are supported by every major scientific organization in America, ranging from the National Academy of Sciences to world organizations such as the World Health Organization, the United Nations. Everyone seems to recognize the importance of genetic modification, and yet the Democratic Party supports labeling these foods as if they are somehow dangerous. Now, interestingly, the American Medical Association took the opposite stance. They said that is not something we should be doing because it will confuse customers and it will confuse shoppers. And the Democratic Party went against the advice of the American Medical Association, yet the Republicans took their side.
Well, as far as food safety is concerned, in Europe, for example, there's anti-GMO regulation in many European countries, and the entire EU bans growth hormones in milk, which is something that you address in the book. Now, is the entire union seized by this kind of anti-science fervor?
The European Union? Exactly. Is that what you're asking? You know, it seems to be in a way that Europeans seem to have an aversion to biotechnology in a way that Americans do not. And that's not coming from me. That's coming from the new appointment, the EU science advisor. Her name is Dr. Anne Glover, who she happens to be a microbiologist just like me. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm a little partial. But she, in an interview with the journal Science, said that Europe seems to have an aversion to biotechnology, particularly genetic modification. And one of the things that is enshrined in the European Union's constitution is the idea of the precautionary principle, which basically states that we should not release anything publicly until we know for certain that it's safe. And that's a problem from a scientific standpoint, because you can never prove something to be safe. You can show something that's unsafe, but you can never prove something to be safe. That sets an impossible standard for scientists to actually achieve. And therefore, because you can never prove it, it becomes very difficult to put new technologies on the market.
That's what I understand in speaking with people or reporting on anti-GMO legislation. There's a lot of question of how early on we are in the process. I mean, right here now, we have frogs in the Connecticut River and the Potomac Basin, sturgeon in the Mississippi with male and female sex organs. There's a 10-year study at Yale linking that to pesticides, herbicides, flame retardants, estrogen. I'm not bringing GMOs in here. But just to get to that point of we don't know what is going to happen down the road, how do we proceed then?
Well, this is something that you have to monitor over years. And in the case of genetic modification, there have been studies for about 20 years, probably even longer than that. The first genetically modified fruit was called the Flavor Saver tomato. And it came on the market, I think, in 1994, if I'm not mistaken. Apparently, a lot of customers didn't think it tasted very good, or there were other competitors on the market because it quickly went off the market. But the answer to the question, how do you know if something is going to be dangerous or not, is that you have to continually monitor it. But do keep in mind that to put something on the market, it has to get approval from the FDA, from the EPA, from the USDA. A lot of different government bureaucracies have to give a stamp of approval, in essence, before you're allowed to feed people with a certain kind of food. And the fact that all of these government bureaucracies have given essentially the stamp of okay to genetic modification, I think, should take the edge off of people's concerns.
Well, here's my lack of objectivity here. I'm guilty, I guess, on some level of mistrusting that, because I think there are plenty of historic examples from vermiculite to thalidomide to DDT of chemicals approved by the government, sold for much profit, that have done great human harm and created serious mistrust. Now, that's the question here I think you're getting to. You're talking about science being politicized and agenda-driven. Then who are we to believe in the arena of politicization and agenda-driven research?
That's a fantastic question. And you know, in the age of the internet, you can find anybody to support any viewpoint that you want.
That's a problem.
And that it's a huge problem. My advice would be to read literature reviews and to read journals from the major scientific journals. So we're talking Nature, Journal of the American Medical Association, the journal Science, the journal PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. These are the huge journals. And I think that what you would find in those journals tends to be a little bit more reliable. Recently, going back to organic food, the Annals of Internal Medicine, a huge globally important medical journal, studied 40 years worth of data from organic food and found that it wasn't any more nutritious than conventionally grown food. And other studies have shown, I don't think it was a review, but other studies have shown that if you look at, for instance, the environment surrounding genetically modified crops, that if you treat the crops, you know, in a way that you're not going to be, you know, spreading genetically modified pollen just willy-nilly across the countryside, that you can sort of kind of contain it if you plant, you know, your conventional crops maybe 50 meters away. And if you plant the genetically modified ones 50 meters away, that there shouldn't be much contamination. And so I think the answer to your question is to, A, we should always continue to monitor genetically modified crops. We should not stop doing that. We should continue doing that for the next 10, 20 years. But at the same time, we should allow technology to move forward and to trust the scientists, trust the medical doctors, and trust and for the most part, trust the scientists and the regulatory bureaucracy, because combined, the doctors, the bureaucrats, and the scientists, I think they know what they're doing.
We're talking with Alex Barrazzo about the rise of what he calls the anti-scientific left. He's a scientist himself and a journalist and co-author of a book called Science Left Behind, which takes down some of the progressive sacred cows, from fear of overpopulation and vaccines to America's standing in scientific research in the world. There's a lot of data in it to counter all of those claims. You know, I know it's easy to fall down the rabbit hole of food, especially in light of the Stanford study on organics that just came out last week. And I've seen a lot of criticism of that study. But I want to get to what you were just talking about how things are covered. The opposition to vaccination has been pretty well covered. We spoke with Seth Mnookin about his book about it. Mm-hmm. One of the big things to come out of that is that science and other journalists are falling down on the job. So how does the media fit in? What are we failing to do in science reporting, and what can we do to make it better?
You know, I think that having more scientific expertise in the newsroom would be a good first step. Because, for instance, a lot of the vaccine autism coverage was covered by general journalists, not by science journalists or health reporters. And so a lot of journalists seem to think that it's necessary to have a balance. Well, we need to have one scientist that says this, and we have another scientist that says the opposite. but that's not how things usually work in science. Usually in science, there's one predominant viewpoint which is more supported by the evidence than the other. And I think having scientifically minded people in the newsroom who can kind of figure that out and ferret out what's the good science from what's the bad science would be a good first step towards fixing that problem.
Most of the things that are raised in the book is really the stuff of great serious scientific discussion. But it was released in this political season. Now, will that help to depoliticize science, releasing a book like this at this time?
Well, we try to take some of the politics out of it by not making it about Republicans and Democrats. Other books have done that, and they say, you know, the Democrats are the problem or the Republicans are the problem. We're trying not to do that. We're trying to say that this problem is more of a way of thinking. It's fastening on to certain myths that seem to associate themselves with the progressive movement. For example, the idea that natural things are better or that unnatural things are bad for you or that unchecked science is somehow destructive, that, you know, science and technology will destroy the planet if we don't keep it in check. And so we try to tackle these ideas from more of a how do people think ideologically rather than how do people think in a partisan Democrat versus Republican way.
Is there any issue where the most scientifically accurate viewpoint lies somewhere in between the policies of, let's just go with that dyad again, of the two parties currently?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think there is a lot of room for negotiation on energy policy, to be honest. If you set aside all the blustering that each side does, I think that we could actually come to an agreement on energy policy. I think that even though a lot of conservatives don't see a problem with global warming, they do see a problem with importing oil, for instance, from the Middle East. They don't like that. So if you can bring them on board by saying, OK, well, this isn't about global warming. It's about getting off of, you know, dictator oil. They might be more on board with that sort of a strategy. And similarly, if you could pitch the same sort of idea to the left side of the spectrum, saying, look, you know, wind and solar are great, and we want to develop those policies. But until then, we might have to rely on natural gas and nuclear power until we get, you know, the gold standard, which would be solar power.
Alex Barrazeau, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Alex Barrazeau, he has a PhD in microbiology, and he's editor of Real Clear Science and co-author of the book Science Left Behind, Feel Good Fallacies and the Rise of the Anti-Scientific Left. We'd love to hear what you think. Are you sticking with organics despite that Stanford study that says you're not really doing anything but paying more for vegetables? Do you think there's an anti-scientific stance in politics that's more egregious than the rest? Or do you find the scientific community possesses just as much rhetoric as the rest of us? Tell us what you think on Facebook, Twitter, or email your thoughts to wordofmouthradio@nhpr.org. Coming up, a scientific, yes, experimentally based study on how where you eat influences what you eat when Word of Mouth continues.